This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll speak with the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta about the confirmation hearings in Washington, D.C. this week for Betsy DeVos, the nominee to be Secretary of Education, as well as the State of the State address tomorrow. But first, the Lyceum Lecture Series at Western Michigan University this semester is called Fulfilling America's Promise, Racial Equity and Justice. It's also part of the events to honor the life of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. The first lecture, Wednesday at noon in the Lee Honors College Lounge, is called Taking Inspiration from Women of the Civil Rights Movement. Mia Henry will deliver that lecture. She is the executive director of the Arcus Center for Social Justice Leadership at Kalamazoo College. Mia Henry, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So as we reach this point in history where a lot of the people who participated in the civil rights movement, unfortunately, have either passed away or are getting older, what don't we know and what maybe is incomplete about the role that women played?
Well, I believe because of the way that history is written, and in particular because of the role that the church had in the civil rights movement, we see often that male leaders, particularly male preachers, are the ones that we know and remember the most, and maybe Rosa Parks, right? And unfortunately, even Rosa Parks gets frozen in time. She was very active in the NAACP in Montgomery. 8 years she had joined before refusing to give up her seat for a second time on the bus in Montgomery. She had been active as a secretary of the NAACP, fighting against men being wrongfully accused of raping white women, black men, and also working for education rights. And she also was the head of the youth league at the NAACP, so very active. And then after refusing to give up her seat, being arrested, she becomes more of a figurehead. And this is what happens to a lot of women who take a stand. They become more of symbols, and known for how they look and how they behaved in that one moment versus what they can contribute over time. Whereas you have Rosa Parks then becoming economically destitute. Less than a year after the boycott begins, she loses her job as an assistant tailor in the department store downtown. Her husband loses his job as a barber on the military base. So they're literally run out of town simply because they can't make a living in Montgomery anymore. They end up moving to Detroit, and she works for Representative John Conyers. That is her next full-time job until she retires a few years before her death. So Rosa Parks, as a working for John Conyers, worked stood up against apartheid, worked for African American history in schools in Detroit, had stood for a lot of issues, and we freeze women in time, particularly if they're not part of the clergy, part of the kind of moral leadership of the civil rights movement.
In the case of Rosa Parks, sometimes she almost comes across as this accidental figure, yeah, who just sort of this one day on the bus said, "Well, I'm tired of having to give up my seat," when in reality, as you point out, she had a long history before that of involvement in the civil rights movement.
Yeah, she had even she'd gone to Highlander Folk School and been trained just a couple of months before, and it worked with King at Highlander Folk School, as well as Miles Horton and Septima Clark, other radical leaders. So she was just like any other active person in the community, that when her moment came to refuse to be dehumanized, to refuse to assert her rights in public, she took that moment. It was a pretty, if you read this, I recommend an incredible book called The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks by Jean Theo Harris, which really chronicles Rosa Parks' life before, during, and after the boycott, and how the breadth of her activist career, what it spans, and how that one moment, even though we define that moment and then we mischaracterize it as one of a quiet woman making a stand that is not thoughtful.
Sort of seems like it's spur of the moment in,
yeah,
in a way it's kind of.
Yeah. And although it wasn't planned, it was not unlike someone like Rosa Parks to make that type of stand. So
when you say that you want to take inspiration, is part of that inspiration from the idea that people did work hard and at the same time maybe didn't get the credit that others got in that movement? Or are you also maybe at the same time trying to set the record a little more straight than we've had it in the past?
I want to make sure that we understand that women in the civil rights movement, just like women in any other capacity, are more than just one moment in time and more than just one act. And I want to make sure that that we understand women as contributing things that are not necessarily seen as traditional leadership, but are absolutely crucial for change to occur. And so we have, and I don't want to give away everything on Wednesday, because the lecture is really going to be more of a workshop, and I want a lot of interaction from the people who attend. And part of it is kind of collectively understanding who we know and who we don't know in the room. But we have women who started their own political party in Mississippi, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Co-founders of that party went and crashed the Democratic National Convention in 1964 and demanded that their delegation be seated instead of the all-white, all-male delegation that Mississippi sent to that convention. They were told they would get two seats after much testimony, one woman who was cut off by President Johnson at the time interrupted in her testimony because it was so moving, and he knew that they would change the thinking of America with their testimony. This woman goes on to then be part of the first congressional challenge from Mississippi, from Black women ever, saying even after the Democratic National Convention is over that the people elected from Mississippi did not represent the state of Mississippi.
I'm wondering if there are perhaps some different roles then that men and women are playing in the civil rights movement, or were playing in the civil rights movement, and if that has maybe been lost a little bit to time and history.
Well, I think yes and no. You do have, yes and no. We understand King as being an incredible orator. Right. He was also a great writer, a great listener, and a great organizer. We have women who are great writers, great listeners, and great organizers, and who also gave speeches, but those speeches are canonized, right? And so I think that there are certain types of leadership skills that we tend to value more than others, and that is public speaking, leading direct action, the face of civil disobedience, if you will, and not more of the community building, the actual paper pushing that is necessary to
knocking
keep
on doors,
knocking
making
on
phone
doors,
calls,
canvassing, making phone calls for sure, but also to start your own political party is not child's work, right? And there's certainly men who've done it. So I think it's both. It's maybe the types of things that women were relegated to, but a lot of women did not just do what they were relegated to. They did more than that, and it is just the attention and the credit is not offered offered to women. Seems to be not enough space in the spotlight for women.
And as you also noted, there is this connection to the church, so therefore you do have...
Which is a very patriarchal place,
yeah, right?
The Black church, yes.
And most men, especially at that time, were, or most of the pastors were men. And it also does lend that to the idea of public speaking, which, again, the person who is up there making the speech tends to get more attention than the person who might have laid the groundwork to help them get there.
Absolutely. And the person who gets more practice at making speeches and really moving a crowd are going to be those men who have those opportunities to lead churches. And churches are so much more than places of worship for the Black community at the time of the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, they are community centers, right? They're where people eat together. They're where people develop deep and long-lasting relationships. So the men who are pastors at these churches are not just preachers on Sunday, but they're really pastors for communities overall. And so they come with that respect that then they transfer to direct action and movement building. And women don't have that kind of social capital at the time that they're able to transfer to what people see as leadership at that time.
Can we draw some links between the civil rights movement, which we tend to associate with the 1960s, and the fight for racial equality, and then the women's movement, which certainly there's some overlap in time, but we tend to think of that more as the 1970s and was more about gender equality. Are there links? Are there comparisons? Are there some things which maybe make those two movements different?
Well, there's certainly lessons that the women's movement is taking from the civil rights movement, and there are certainly women from the civil rights movement who are going on to join and lead campaigns in women's rights later on in the 70s. And there's also friction between white women leaders and women of color during that time. We see that in the academy. We see that in popular culture because the women's movement in the 70s is also driven by magazines like Ms. Magazine and by shows like the Mary Tyler Moore Show and things that are happening in popular culture that are really making the face of the women's movement a white woman's face. And so you see these real valid tensions coming up between women of color and white women, and they're not being, again, a place in the spotlight or in the canon and then now in our historical record of women of color, their role and their fights for equality on both for both gender and race, right? So racism shows up in the women's movement, but there's also definitely a lot of parallels and a lot of lessons that the women's movement is learning from the civil rights movement. A great book that leads into this is was actually about SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, that had probably more women are given their due in SNCC than other organizations. It's a secular organization and not a Christian one like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And so a great book, SNCC, Many Minds, One Heart, the story of SNCC by Wesley Hogan is a great book to look at both the struggles of SNCC, but also how a lot of women in SNCC went on to be part of the women's movement in the 70s.
So as I noted in the introduction, you are the executive director of the Arcus Center for Social Justice Leadership at Kalamazoo College. You and I are here speaking on the Martin Luther King holiday. On Friday, a new president will take office, and there has been a lot of concern raised about things that he has said in terms of race, in terms of gender, etc. As someone in the social justice realm, how do you view the new presidency of Donald Trump?
Well, needless to say, it's frightening, and it's no longer a prospect. It's a frightening reality, and we now see, with Trump just not only being unable to take criticism and heed that and listen to that and integrate that, but also attacking anyone who criticizes him, including John Lewis, a great civil rights leader who it's well documented all of the things that he has sacrificed for this country, completely dismissing all of the love and beauty that exists in his district in Georgia, simply because John Lewis had a criticism towards him is really, it's really frightening. And I feel like today we're talking about Martin Luther King. In thinking about Martin Luther King, we have to understand that what Trump has shown us so far is that he represents and advocates everything that King fought against. And we need to make sure that today, as we reflect on what King did, he did more than just give speeches. And that's in order to honor him, we don't have to give a speech, but we can write. I'm sitting here with a Radical King book full of essays and speeches that King had wrote over his short 13-year career as an activist or legacy as an activist. He listened to people. He mobilized with people. He reflected daily. He prayed. Some of us meditate. But he did a lot more than give speeches. And we should study the whole of how King led with love in order to know what we see in the upcoming presidency that goes against all of that. So I feel like that's my advice to myself and to everyone else is to look at the whole of what the women in the civil rights movement did and what King did. They're full human beings with many, many skills that they deployed for justice. And we need to hone our skills, study, and practice, and be ready.
Mia Henry, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Mia Henry is the executive director of the Arcus Center for Social Justice Leadership at Kalamazoo College. She will deliver the first lecture in the Lyceum series at Western Michigan University this semester. It begins Wednesday at noon in the Lee Honors College Lounge. Henry's lecture is called Taking Inspiration from Women of the Civil Rights Movement. It's also part of the events at Western Michigan University to honor the legacy of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. By Friday, the United States will have a new president, and it will be a very busy week leading up to Donald Trump's inauguration, especially in Michigan. A confirmation hearing is scheduled for Betsy DeVos's nomination as Secretary of Education, and Governor Rick Snyder will deliver his State of the State address. Rick Pluta is the Michigan Public Radio Network's Capitol Bureau Chief, and he joins us from Lansing. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Gordon.
So first of all, give us the update on Betsy DeVos's confirmation hearing. When can we expect to see this?
That confirmation hearing is going to be tomorrow evening. As a matter of fact, it'll separate from the governor beginning his State of the State speech by just a couple of hours. And they are preparing. It was supposed to happen last week, but as we heard, that it was delayed so that the Office of Government Ethics could do more in terms of its due diligence and looking into possible conflicts of interest and finances and whatnot. And so now game day will be tomorrow afternoon, and that's exactly the way that both sides are looking at it. That this is, you know, at least for that this is the big game.
And big game in the sense that there is going to be something of a campaign going on here that you've reported on, that Betsy DeVos has a communications team which is trying to win support, really not so much for her a nomination, but for her ideas that she would implement as Secretary of Education.
Absent some cataclysmic turn of events, it seems highly unlikely that the DeVos nomination can be derailed. However, it can be a forum for her ideas on expansive school choice, all across the country. And so they are already preparing, you know, success stories and information and support from families who actually use charter schools or school choice or something like that. What they want is they want Betsy DeVos not just to survive confirmation, but to be able to step into the job in a strong position to enact the agenda that she has in mind. And the job of the opposition, and this is largely a partisan divide, Republicans versus Democrats, the job of the Democrats in this case will be to try and make that agenda as untenable as possible, to attack it, the record, how successful charters and choice have actually been, and so, you know, make it more difficult in terms of public support for Betsy DeVos to, you know, get in and just start rolling.
So the idea here is everyone's kind of focusing on what the issues are, with the assumption that Betsy DeVos sometime in 2017 will be taking over as Secretary of Education.
Yeah, I mean, there will be some attention paid, no doubt, to the fact that Betsy DeVos and the DeVos family are among the largest financial supporters of the Republican Party and Republican candidates in the country, including some Republican senators who sit on the Senate Education Committee. But really, it sounds like most of the battle is going to be a policy fight over whether or not expansive school choice is really a good idea for education across the country.
And you noted that Betsy DeVos and her supporters will have some families there who will testify or come to her defense and say, look, this school improved my child's well-being or improved my child's education. What will the other side that maybe wants to blunt Betsy DeVos's efforts be doing?
Well, the way it was described to me is this is actually going to play out a lot like what we see during presidential debates, where there will be people who will be taking the things that are said in the hearing, the claims that are made, allegations that come out, and answering them in real time on social media, in email blasts. There will also be surrogates on hand who will give a particular perspective on some aspect of choice, whether we're talking about cross-district choice or vouchers for religious schools or charter schools, but, you know, all kinds of people coming in and representing a particular position on that, not just in hopes of persuading senators to support or oppose the nomination, but to do the same thing with the public, that this will be a political campaign of sorts.
Are both sides then maybe hoping to make this a referendum over the issue of school choice, charter schools, et cetera?
On the issue of school choice, yes, absolutely. That's what they want to do, is that they want to make the public aware and they want to get the public engaged on one side or the other of the school choice movement.
Of course, school choice is not just an issue in Michigan, but Michigan has many charter schools thanks to the efforts of Betsy DeVos and her family and their education groups, which they've run. Will they try to make a case here that Michigan is better off with the huge increase that the state has seen in charter schools?
Team DeVos will try to make the case that Michigan is better off because of the school choice that's here, but they will also make the case that Michigan isn't the best measure of whether or not school choice is the way to go, because Michigan is still an anti-voucher state, that the state constitution says that no public funds can go directly or indirectly to private or religious schools. And you might, you know, remember that many, many years ago, the DeVos family backed a ballot proposal to try and amend the Constitution to repeal that language and allow vouchers, and it went down. So Michigan, they will say, is not what they call a pure choice state, but just a partial choice state. And so it's not a real measure of what an expansive choice landscape, how that would work out.
And will the other side be trying to highlight some of the problems that there have been with lower test scores, say, in some of the charter schools in Detroit, et cetera?
Oh, exactly. They'll point out that, you know, based on test scores overall, that charter schools are, you know, have not been shown to be much better, if they're better at all, than traditional public schools, and that they don't have to take all the students that that come in, that they're not allowed to necessarily turn away students. But there are a lot of students who, as a practical matter, might not go to a charter school because it doesn't have the right special education program, for example. Transportation can also be an issue. Those things will come into it as part of the Michigan experience.
So as Governor Rick Snyder prepares to give his State of the State address tomorrow night, I wonder if you can maybe just, for our audience, maybe put a little bit of some context here about maybe the different atmosphere compared to a year ago when, of course, the Flint water crisis was, at that point, really very much in the news. Of course, it has continued mm-hmm. to be for a year. But is there a little different feeling to this State of the State address as opposed to last year, when that had really hit the front pages fairly recently, right before he gave that speech?
Yeah, I think so. That you might remember that really pretty much half of the speech last year was devoted to efforts to rescue Flint, and the governor delivered a very emotional apology directly to the people of Flint. I don't think we will see necessarily that much attention specifically on Flint, although he can't deliver a speech without bringing it up. But there is going to be a lot of attention to infrastructure, and certainly that brings into play Flint, not to mention the sinkhole over in Macomb County, and various road repairs, various other infrastructure challenges that are facing Michigan. And so I think we can expect to hear quite a bit about where the governor would like to go with that.
When the governor went over to Macomb County and visited the area where that sinkhole was, one of the first things he said was, "Here's an example of our aging infrastructure."
Mm-hmm.
Is it an actual opportunity here for the governor to make this case, which he has been for a while, that he's got a real tangible example here of what happens when a sewer line collapses, which has been allowed to stay there for so many years.
It is an opportunity for the governor to make that case. But the question is, how far will he go in pursuing it? You know, will he actually talk about specific funding ideas? Because that's where, you know, that's where this always runs into it. Remember the whole debate about funding road repairs, that his goals in terms of generating revenue for that were a lot more ambitious than what Republicans in the legislature were willing to sign on for. Can he make the persuasive argument that the level of infrastructure investment that he wants is something that the legislature would go along with?
And we also have at the same time the revenue estimates, which just came out recently, show mm-hmm. that at least short term, Michigan's got a little bit of money that might go to something. Some lawmakers are talking about tax relief. Could we be in this situation where there's the back and forth of tax relief or infrastructure, at least for the short term?
The governor may have to go about quelling some tax cut fever among the Republican caucuses in the legislature. His budget chief warned after these new revenue estimates came out that, yeah, things are looking good in the short term, but you know, long-term tax rollbacks are probably, at least substantial ones, are probably not in the cards based on the projections that are further out.
And then we have at the same time some lawmakers who are introducing bills which are aimed at least in the long term, completely phasing out Michigan's income tax. If we're looking at what the governor has said so far and what we think he's going to say in the state of the state, is there any reason to believe that he's going to hop aboard that bandwagon?
I doubt that he will hop aboard it. He probably won't, shoot a torpedo into it because that's not his style. He likes to work with the legislature. And of course, you know, when you talk about rollbacks that take place over decades, that they can be, you know, pretty incremental. The thing is, if you're a real, anti-tax advocate, you know, you'll look at that and go, well, but, you know, no legislature can tell a future legislature what to do. And so you can start an income tax, rollback scheme, but that doesn't mean that it's going to play out in the end.
So the legislative session came to an end with what was called a fairly quiet lame duck session for the time after the election. But there were a fair number of issues that kind of got left on the table, some things that would seem to have some bipartisan support, like prison reform, but maybe some other contentious issues like reforming teacher retirement. Does there seem to be anything that the governor especially has his eye on that the legislature did not pass in that last month before they adjourned?
Well, there are two that immediately come to mind, and one of them is the teacher retirement health care and public employee retirement health care, which are separate but related. And legislative leaders have said that they want to go back and revisit that. The governor has been on board in principle, you know, when it comes to doing that. The problem is that some of the fixes that have been proposed have a lot of big upfront costs that the state would have trouble handling. And so there's actually just some actuarial arguments over what the best approach to doing this might be. Another one is the cost of auto insurance and a no-fault overhaul. Now, this comes up every year, and it just always goes down in defeat or fizzles out somehow because Michigan, even though it's unique in having unlimited medical benefits, it's popular here. People like the fact that if something happens, something catastrophic, that they know that they or their loved ones are going to be taken care of no matter what. And that's just been too much for the people involved in this to bridge. So that will probably come up. It's just a question of whether or not this time, unlike all the previous times, that something could get done with that. But we also know that the new House Speaker, Tom Leonard, that was his mission in the last session, was to try and come up with something that would do something about auto insurance rates.
Rick Pluta is the Capitol Bureau Chief of the Michigan Public Radio Network. He joined us from Lansing. Rick, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Gordon.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.